In my ends, football player, the juice man had from young. After man practice, I stole me a grab, kaya roof, just get pelt down. Take off with a speed, come me fair to the vagrant man, get mad, pan we cunt. Scatter, scatter, run, me no say the enemy, I wish say we burn. Hold on, they nigga. I don't mind, girl, I go there with the flavor. Let me follow, she the wrong on the corner. Better say she a live wrong, I check her. Way away from my man, take her. Put me back out, this out here later. Scatter, scatter, run, me no say me enemy, I wish say me burn. Boy, oh, Lord, burn, when you say fire, burn, them.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to another episode of One from the Vaults, the podcast that brings you all of the dirt, gossip, and glamour from trans history. I'm your host, Morgan M. Page. This year, to celebrate the fifth anniversary of the podcast, I'm bringing together some of my favorite artists, historians, and archivists to talk about the work they do with trans history. Because though I would love to take credit for all of trans history, in reality, there are so many people doing incredible work out there, and I really want to share this platform with them. This month, I'm speaking to Librada Gonzalez Fernandez of the Cubane Queer Archive, a project drawing together the archives of queer and trans Cubans on the island and in the Cuban diaspora. Librada is a young trans woman based in Miami and New York who has spent the past couple of years working on this archive with no funding. Like me, she just wants to get this history off the shelf and back into the hands of the community. So yeah, again, thank you so much for joining me today, Librada. Ever since our mutual friend Serge turned me on to your work, I've been completely obsessed. I follow the archive very obsessively and I read every post, both because I'm super interested for lots of reasons in Cuban queer history, but also it's been so helpful for me because I'm learning Spanish right now and it's a bilingual archive. So I'm like challenging myself to try to read the Spanish before I skip to the English. So it's really good.
Good.
But I was thinking maybe we could start with one of the stories that you found so far compiling the archive. Like, tell me a story. Whatever story comes to mind.
Okay, so I'll tell you exactly what I'm doing now, which is I'm doing research on female impersonation, drag, all that kind of performance and burlesque in Cuba, because it all started back in October. I was online looking at magazine from this drag show in New York in the 70s. And I found this performer, his name was Adrian, and that's the only name I had, which was in his real name. And I look him up and I ended up finding somebody to public records who lived in New York, who was 93. I went to interview him and all this led to me diving into the world of female impersonation. And a lot of, I met a lot of gay men at first in this world. And I was, you know, I was just like really excited for him, like, where are the trans women in this world? Because I know in my experience going to drag shows and all these in this world, there's a lot of trans women who still today get initiated into this kind of like, into the world of like, you know, breaking whatever away from their gender, their conceived gender presentation or whatever in this world. So where are the trans women in the 1950s Cuban drag world? And I found none for the longest time. or for like a month and a half, and I was really disappointed. And I'm like, wait a minute, these men have to be concealing something from me. They indeed were. But that was not the whole story. They were misgendering some people who had passed away. And that's something that I knew happened, but I, you know, it's hard to tell somebody, oh, it's not a he, it's a she, because, you know, it's their own experience. So you don't want to talk over them. But in this case, I did. But anyway, what I found was that a lot of trans women who are in this world, because it was the 1950s, because it was around New York, had transitioned physically to the point where they were back in the closet, where nobody knew that they had you know, been trans women. Sorry, not been trans women, but like, you know, like been clockable at some point in their lives. And it kind of killed me, because I wanted these women to be part of the research. And all of a sudden I was not dealing with the censorship that gay men do, which is like they erase trans, with that erasure that gay men do. I was dealing with the erasure that comes with, like, you know, trans women's safety and the fact that they have to survive, and they had to. So all this to say is that I'm now at a point in my research in which I'm trying to decide, do I reach out to them? How do I go about this? One of them recently passed away, actually, like days ago. She was in hospice and she wrote a book. Her name is Marinka Hunter, which is also something else I have to say, is it's so interesting how so many of them, when they change their name, they kind of like anglicize it too. And the process of like assimilation in that way too. And I have a book now in the archive, which is now a scrapbook that was donated by a gay man that was in the drag world, that includes the names of many trans women who are not out, out, I guess I'll say it that way. And now I have this information in my hand that I can share. I can't kind of, cause it's, you know, it's their lives and they're still alive. And I can't say, look, there's a precedent to this. There are people living here, because they're all living, they're trying to just live a life and be fulfilled. And that's, the story is so much more exciting when I can give you the full details of who these people are. But it's something I knew happened. It's something, you know, in disclosure, in the documentary, there was a one trans woman that recently came out. I forgot what her name was. But I didn't feel it until now, until I did this research and came to that dead end, and then realized it wasn't a dead end, but indeed it was in another way, because I couldn't. I had this information in my hand, but I couldn't share it. And there was another story. It was the sister of a cis gay drag queen. And he kept saying, my brother this. And I was like, you know, through the things he told me, I was like, wait a minute, that doesn't sound like a brother. The fact that at 12, she ran away from home and she joined like a group of sex workers, and they called her, because this is confusing because of other stories he told me. They called her by like some Cuban vedette's name. And I just knew it wasn't just a cis gay man. And indeed it wasn't. And it was through another trans woman in New York that I found out that Pamela was indeed a trans woman. But when I asked the cis gay drag queen, do you have a picture of your sister? All he could provide was a 1950s pre-transition black and white photo in which a dog was more in focus than his own sister. And I was just like, wow. And all these things are coming really, like, you know, coming really hitting home, because since the pandemic, I moved back home to my family in Miami. And I have seen a lot of, not permanently, I don't want to do this, I'm just trying to save rent in New York, but it has really hit home for me, because I have seen kind of like my erasure, or the process of my marginalization, in real time, as I compare it to how this marginalization process happened for these people who are older, and how it's happening for me. in the way that my family doesn't address me by my name or doesn't address me by my pronouns. And then the up and coming generations, my nieces who don't see me as their aunt, you know, all those things. And there it is, the end of that line is seeing a picture of, you know, your own sister. You don't even have a picture of your own sister after she's passed away.
Wow, that's really intense.
Yeah, and I didn't want to leave with a mood killer. it's given me a lot of hope in a strange way and a lot of relief to know these people did exist and that I was able to find them.
Yeah, very powerful. And I feel like this, what you've just described, really brings up a lot of the themes that I hope we'll go into as we talk today. I'm like, in my head, I'm like, oh, she's hitting all the good ones. Like, there's things here about like the ethics of archival practices, diaspora and assimilation, like all these really interesting topics that I had written down that I want to go into. But before we jump directly into those, like, how did Cubane Queer come about? Like, what is it exactly? How did you start doing it? Just give me the elevator pitch on it.
Okay, so I love starting with I was very lonely because I think it's a very universal feeling. I was very lonely when I started Cubane Queer, and I was trying to find a community. I didn't know how to find it. I had just moved to New York. I was, you know, from Cuba and then raised in Miami. I was always hot and, you know, never cold. So all of a sudden I'm in New York in February. I have to wear all these kinds of coats. I can't go out because it's too cold for me. I have no friends. And my refuge at that point was the library. So I went to the library and I started doing research. And I found Reinaldo Arenas's Before Nightfall, which, mind-blowing, that for the first time I was like, because I came to the US when I was 11, I learned, or I came into my queerness around my teen years. So I found my queer community in English, but I found my kind of the foundation of who I am in Spanish. So I didn't know those things existed together, or that I could even put those things together. And then having somebody speak about this world. And I don't want to curse, but let me know if it's okay. I will. Great. I was like trying to find this world of factory and like transvestite wonder in Spanish. I was like, oh my God, I could actually, I don't have to code switch. I can really be those two things at the same time. Funny enough, it was Renato Arenas's book, which is very transphobic, very racist, and as much as it is beautiful too. And then I was like, okay, I'm done with this book. It was great. There has to be a collection of like trans authors, of like non-binary people who have written in Cuba. And then, you know, the people who I found, you know, I found one person who was one non-binary person in Cuba who I, you know, from this age. And then I found by trans women literature, I couldn't find a lot. And I found that there was a lot of cis gays talking about trans women and trans people in general. And then I was like, well, where are we? You know, and then of course these books were written in the past too. So a lot of people who came out later were also misgendered at the point. And all this led to, you know, I was reading at the library, I wanted a community, I was thinking about my friends in Miami who were second generation Cubans who did not have a connection with the Cuban community, even less with the Cuban queer community. And I was like, wait a minute, I can do this. I can kind of bridge that gap between, because also the people in Cuba didn't have a connection to my friends in the US. Mm. I know both languages. This is like, I can speak in both languages in both cultures, you know? Maybe I can bridge that gap. I can bring together those two cultures. I can make my friends feel like they have a heritage and make myself feel like I have a heritage. And, you know, with all modesty aside, I wanted a project that like preserved me too. I was afraid of being lost. And when I founded Kubana Queer, I was like, you know what? This is the most beautiful way to like preserve myself is to do it through other people. Mm-hmm. And to keep myself alive through, through like an act of love of keeping my friends alive or my ancestors alive. And it's given me a lot of purpose in that way too.
Yeah. That's really beautiful. One of the things, I mean, I relate so much to what you're talking about because I feel like in a similar vein, my whole podcast has been this attempt to reconnect like my friends and my communities with the lineage that they come from, that we've been had this sort of historical rupture from, you know? But you wrote about it so beautifully on one of your Instagram posts. You wrote, to a queer archive that decentralizes cisgender and white experiences, to a queer archive that will include a diversity of sexualities and physical abilities, to a queer archive that belongs to us. Can you talk a bit about how this stance kind of shapes your archival practice and like the stories you dig into?
Yeah. I have to start with, especially I have been trying really hard to find more Black stories of, stories that are outside of who I am, you know, a white, able-bodied Cuban. I have been trying to find, you know, more transmasculine stories, more Black stories, stories of people with disabilities. And I'll say in the stories of Black queer Cubans, it has been really hard, not because they're not there, but the way they're kept like in these archives that, you know, like the other day I had to reach out to the University of Arkansas and they're closed because now because of the pandemic, it's even more difficult. Everything is kept away. It's coded so that you don't find, so it's coded in a different language, first of all. And I'll say that I wanted an archive, not with the Library of Congress of cataloging system or whatever. I wanted to, you know, catalog it myself as I know my community. And in a kind of like boost of confidence in the kind of way that like cis white men do without any permission, I just said, you know what? I'm a historian now, fuck it. I'm gonna be the person who does this work. I'm not the most prepared. I'm very young and I'm very inexperienced, but nobody else is doing it. Or if they're doing it, they're doing it wrong. So, you know, what's wrong with me doing a little bit wrong too, or without experience? I don't want this to be an archive that's going to be just my work. Hopefully more people can jump in eventually. Recently there was a post that I removed actually.
That was going to be my next question for you, actually.
Yeah, that makes us into this. I removed that post because I was talking to a colleague who runs Historia Negra de Cuba, which is about queer Cuban Black history in general. And he mentioned that, you know, he didn't post on his page any, because we were sharing like shitty things that white people say or like have kept in archives, you know, about Black history or stupid white perspectives. And then I was like, oh my God, you should share this. It's good material to share. And he's like, well, I don't want to share these kind of things because I don't want to kind of like continue that like line of just trauma porn, I guess. And at first I was like, what do you mean you don't want to share? You only want to share positive stuff? Is that like, and then I realized, wait a minute, the post that I've shared that got the most engagement, reach rather, was, well, everything, reach, engagement, comments, everything, was the post of a Black person being humiliated. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I was like, wait a minute, I'm part of that system that's creating Black trauma porn. And I'll tell you the story of that video actually, without jumping too far away from that. That video belonged, or the video was taken from the Armed Forces building in Cuba in the 1990s by Total Movie Moment director of the film Looking for a Space, Kelly Anderson, met with a worker from the Armed Forces building in an alleyway in Havana, and they exchanged a videotape for $300, and she took it to the US. And you know, that moment, right after I dug that research, because that had been out for a while, but people had kind of forgotten about it. It kind of, people forgot about it, and then they started asking Kelly for the video, because people just all of a sudden wanted the video. It was the 40th anniversary of the Marielle. Queer studies is like, you know, gaining popularity or whatever. And I just really hate, that I have shared so many stories of joy, of just, you know, of beautiful queer things, and people don't share that. And also I have shared stories of hate from the United States, and they don't share that. Because the narrative that speaks to a lot of Cubans in exile, especially cis people, is anti-Castro sentiment, and that's about it. Mm. There's not a lot of what is it, analysis from there down. It's a lot of just like, fuck Castro, he was bad, and then no analysis of the U.S., no critique to this country, no critique to other, you know, to imperialist countries, just right there.
Well, I thought it was really interesting. Because, you know, on your post, you write that Black suffering is not content to boost engagement. And I found that really powerful coming from an archive before, because I've never seen an archive openly grapple with the ethics of its own archival practice before, ever. Like, I follow so many different archives. No one has ever thought in public about it in that way that I've seen anyway. So I was quite moved. And it is something that, you know, as I've made this podcast over the past 5 years, I've struggled a lot with the kind of the broader ethical issues of doing these stories. And I've had to kind of, because like you, I'm also not super trained. I'm not like, you know, I don't have a PhD in history or whatever. I'm just digging around in the archives. Like, I've had to really kind of draw up my own lines for where it's ethical to tell a story and where it's not. So now I don't do stories about living people, just as a rule, because I don't think, like, I don't know if I'm outing them, like, whatever, you know, I have to be careful for people. But yeah, I was wondering, like, are there other angles through which you've kind of thought through the ethics of the work that you're doing? Like, you kind of talked about it earlier with these trans women that, you know, who've kind of gone stealth, like, aren't out about being trans, but like, what other ways has this come up for you? Because of course, it's also like a very, my understanding is, a tricky political situation for some people in Cuba, and for those in the Cuban diaspora who might want to visit. Are these things that you take into account?
Absolutely. I mean, I have to say that for that post, well, first I'm gonna say, I don't wanna be wrong, but I know that being wrong is very important to, like, mm-hmm. learning. And I was wrong, you know, I was wrong or whatever. It was not, I'm not gonna put the full blame on myself or whatever, because that's whatever, a dumb game. But when I posted that post originally, I was really excited, in the same way that I, you know, one time I was at the Cuban Heritage Collection, and the librarian Martin came up to me and he's like, "What are you doing? You look so happy." And I'm like, "I'm looking at homophobic cartoons from the 60s. And I had a smile this big." And he was like, "Wait, what do you mean?" And, you know, and I was like, because this is exciting to me. I have proved that my people exist. And that video for me was proof that A, queer people were treated horribly, as the government in Cuba has tried to deny. B, that Marielle was a very queer exile. And that, you know, it was a poignant video. That's why I also got shared a lot. It was an 11-second video that sends chills down your spine, mm-hmm. as much as it is traumatic. And I was excited to dig this research and say, where the hell is this from? Where did she take this footage from? Which I ended up calling her, because the credits from that movie are not in the film. I had to call her and ask where it was from. And I was just excited to share it because it was research. And I kind of like, I battled that idea of like, wait, do I censor it? Do I not? It's, if it was a physical archive, and that video still remains accessible, it's still on the web. I provided the link, provided the information. Whoever wants to can still see it. It's there. Mm. But I don't need to give it a, you know, a front page in my archive. And, you know, it's still getting comments a year later, mm-hmm. more than any other post. So, yeah, the ethics I deal with are my own personal ethics, the best ones that I can bring. And one of the things that I try to do is I try to not be puritanical in the way that, you know, institutional archives are, because that hurts, you know, the queer community in the first place, because they have censored our stories or kept them away from archives for such a long time or erased them because they thought that, you know, queer bodies were obscene. Mm-hmm. So they said, you know what, this does not need to be archived. This is just some tomfoolery, or this is whatever the hell. So as much as I try to, you know, apply my own personal ethics, I'm not afraid of being wrong, or I'm okay with it, or I'll be okay. I'll get over that bridge when it comes with being wrong, and I will be wrong in the future. So the reason why I made that post public and I, you know, made a graphic about my thought process was because part of the reason why I also have an archive is to educate people, and not that I'm an educator, but, you know, for people to learn. Well, I am an educator, but for people to learn from the process that I went through as well, mm-hmm. which was, you know, calling friends and, you know, calling some of my friends and discussing, and then, you know, grappling with, do I post this, do I not take it down? Being transparent. I think that's honesty is the best policy here.
Yeah, I love that. And what has kind of, you've kind of gestured a bit towards the political situation in Cuba and the revolution's erasure of queer lives and bodies. And I do want to get to that, but I'll give you a softball question first, which is, like, what's the reaction been to the archive from queer and trans Cubans in America, as well as those in Cuba?
It has been such a positive reaction. I have, like, overwhelmingly positive. You know, I have 900 followers or whatever on Instagram, but it's, in real life, I have, you know, it's so moving when I go to Cuba and people are like, we're going to organize an event so you can have this and, you know, so you can talk about it. And Librada is the keeper of our stories and whatever. It has really been uplifting in that way. And for the US, my friends in the US do the same. And I have no complaints about it. I'm very moved by it. It brought a bigger sense or a bigger feeling of that community. Definitely that I can't do it alone. I'm not thinking that I am the speaker of everybody who I'm posting about. But I am kind of like, you know, I'm the little fairy that's going around and like kind of making little connections. And I'm okay with that. I love that. It's draining sometimes, I have to say. And that's like a huge talk about how I've been in interviews with people and I'm like, you know, after an interview for like 6 hours straight, you know, I've you know, tuned in and out. Thankfully I'm recording it, but I'm tuning in and out constantly. Because I'm a very empathetic person and you know, it's a lot. And it triggers a lot inside me too. But generally the reaction in Cuba, when I go to Cuba, first thing is people don't know what an archive is a lot of times, and also happens here. They don't know what I'm doing, why I'm doing it, why I want old pieces of paper, or why I want like random things that they don't consider important. I think it's also uplifting in a way when I say this that you own, this part of your history deserves, your underwear in which you took this picture deserves to go, and, you know, in a box, in an archival acid-free box for like posterity. Queer people are not used to feeling important like that a lot. I mean, I'm not, as a queer person. So when, you know, when people say, wow, your story is incredible, I mean, I think I help do that in a way. I am creating the importance that queer history might not have in regular or institutional archives.
Yeah, it's amazing. So I hinted at this before, but let's get into the politics for a moment. Cuba has kind of long been idealized on the American left as this sort of symbol of resistance to capitalism. And even like Leslie Feinberg wrote that book, Rainbow Solidarity with Cuba, which definitely presents a certain vision of Cuba as this space of like queer communist liberation. But this doesn't necessarily line up with Cuba's history, right? Where you have like forced labor camps for homosexuals and quarantine colonies for people living with HIV and the sort of let them leave, or I think it's like que se vayan kind of mentality around the Mario boat lift, right? What can you tell us about how Cuban trans and queer people are treated in contemporary Cuba? Like, I'm thinking of things like the relationship between Cenosex and queer activists or things like that. Sorry, this is a big mouthful of a question.
No. But... I got you. You know, I have, you know, this is like, I have to say, first of all, in the Cubans, you know, on the Cuban side, every country makes mistakes. Every country has a shitty historical past regarding queer people. The UMAP camps, the labor camps, you know, that was happening. You know, they ended in 1968, and 1969 was the Stonewall, you know, riots. So what the fuck does the US have to, like, you know, say about the way they treated queer people here? But in present day Cuba, the thing that bothers me the most, that sits on me like a needle, it's that all these people creating change and creating spaces and being the saviors of queer people are cis, het, mostly white people, starting with the person who's sitting at the head of Cenosex, who's a white cis het woman. You know, whatever. I have to say this because Cenosex has a lot of nuances to it in the political spectrum. Because I'm the first person when somebody says fuck Castro to be like, and like, you know, I need like an addendum to that, because that's not the only feeling I have. You know, I say fuck Castro in the same way I might say fuck Nixon or, you know, fuck Trump, which, you know, I love how like diametrically opposed they apparently are. To me, they're all just cishet men. you know, when people come to me saying fuck Castro, I want to say, well, is a society you want going to include me? Because the first thing that those people are going to do, which are like, you know, the semi-fascists that are, or fascists that are living here in Florida that want liberation for Cuba, because everybody has a different idea of liberation. Those people that want liberation, the first thing they're going to do is take down Cenosex and say, no, the faggots don't deserve a fucking space here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's in the way that I say, you know what? I understand Cenosex, Mariela and her, you know, posse needs to stay there. But no, I don't want, you know, when people say, you know, so many of my trans friends in Cuba who say things like, oh, thank you, Mariela, because, you know, you've saved us from Egypt and you walked us around, you know, across the Red Sea or whatever the hell. You know, it's disingenuous. It reminds me of the people who argue that, you know, Kamala Harris, you know, paved the way for Black women here in the U.S. It's like, no, there have been countless activists, you know, people who have put their body on the line to make this a reality. Mariela Castro did not, you know, create queerness and, you know, and you know, our struggle, the timeline of our struggle does not compare to even the fucking lifetime of Mariela Castro. So, you know, whatever we have, we created ourselves. If a cis person gave us the mercy of, you know, creating a center for us, they owe us that already in the first place. And, you know, people might say this is, you know, radical politics or whatever, because I'm not being thankful for what they're saying, for what they've done for us. But we deserve that for the longest time. And, you know, I'm in Miami now, which is a very, as much as, you know, I live in Hialeah, which is a working class neighborhood. My mother is the kind of person that says, oh, I like to work at Home Depot because they put the boot on my back, you know, and they make me work harder. I'm just saying that because there's a lot of class mingled into this too. A lot of people mm-hmm. who think that they have to thank the government for, you know, scraps mm-hmm. All the time. And in Cuba, people who are used to, you know, living in, not everybody in Cuba is used to living in shitty conditions, but many people are, and queer people, especially in my hometown, which is, you know, very rural too. Of course they're thankful because for the first time somebody's thought of them, but we deserve a lot more than just, you know, Mariela Castro running CenaSex and all the histories of queerness in Cuba being written by cishet men too. Mm. Well, not cishet men, cis people. I'll say that much. Mm-hmm. But like the two that were written from Cuba, well, the first two were written by cishet men. Go figure. Mm-hmm. So thank you for having the privilege.
Right. So you've just brought up, you know, Hialeah, and I feel like this is a good jumping off point to talk a bit about diaspora, because your archive engages the history of Cubans in Cuba, but also, as you've been kind of talking about, Cubans who now live elsewhere, let's say, like in the diaspora. So, you know, given the revolution's early treatment of homosexuals, the diasporic journey has for many been a necessity, particularly in the period of the Mariel boat lift. I happen to know some gay Marielitos myself, actually. And of course, the grand dame of Cuban expat writers in the 20th century is noted lesbian Lydia Cabrera, right? But I also saw one of your Instagram posts features a clip of how like cis straight people played up gay stereotypes so they would be allowed to leave the island, which I thought was fascinating. So I'm just wondering if you can talk a bit about the Cuban queer diaspora and how you're working that into your archival practice.
Well, first, there's something that a friend in Havana said that's very ingenious. And he said that, you know, there's a lot of information coming about Cuba into the diaspora, but there's never any information from the diaspora coming into Cuba. And the history of Cubans in the diaspora, it's kind of set, well, until the internet came, which was, you know, very recently, quite ignored in Cuba, because Cuba was shut off from the world for a long time. And I mean, diaspora is just, I mean, part of my search at the New York Public Library was I wanted, like, you know, my white friends to find this fake idea, which is as false for me as it is for their whiteness. I wanted this, like, I want lineage that I can trace back to, like, the Mayflower or whatever the hell. And, you know, I found myself grappling with being a full peasant that, you know, whose history was not recorded, being queer, and trying to find queer history in my peasant lineage, which I was like, wait a minute, the closest I have is my uncle, who's, you know, who's now, you know, alone, isolated, mentally ill, and living alone in a very rural town where he probably is, the reason he's probably living alone is because he's hooking up with men at night, you know, and so diaspora is trying to find a lineage, realizing that I can never achieve such a pure line or whatever. And that has to do with white supremacy, this whole idea of like purity of, you know, like you have a pure lineage and all that stuff. I couldn't find that. And instead I just said, what if I just, instead of thinking that I'm just some like mutant that doesn't have a pure background, why don't I just say I'm Cuban and throw all caution to the wind? You know, just, that's it, I'm Cuban and fuck it. You know, whatever, I have Spanish in my blood, and you know, whatever the hell 23andMe might say if I do the test. But looking at Cuban history, I realized there were so many people who were part of a Cuban canon, like Atue, who was like the first revolutionary, who was like this indigenous person, he wasn't Cuban, he was Dominican. And then you have, you know, Martí, who's like Jose Martí, who's like, you know, white Cuba's leader of like cis, whatever the hell. Martí spent most of his life outside of Cuba. And so countless of these examples, Máximo Gómez, who was Dominican as well, all these examples of people who are not in Cuba or who are not Cuban, who made a tremendous difference for Cuba. So in that moment, I didn't decide to be Cuban or not. It was kind of like, I decided to marry Cuba. I was like, I'm gonna marry this country and just make it mine and be audacious that way. And I feel like that's what a lot of people in the diaspora kind of have trouble with, you know, in my experience, is that they don't feel Cuban enough, they don't feel connected to Cuba enough. And Cubans are very, oh, you're from the US, you're a gringa, you know, or if you're here, oh, you're not. And when they come here and they go to Connecticut or whatever, they're, you know, the most Latina girl, you know, in the world. So they're stuck in living on the hyphen or having to rent an island in the middle of Florida and Cuba. And I just said, you know what? I'm Cuban enough and I'm gringa enough and I'm tired enough too of having to choose, of playing this game of purity. As I said, I just chose Cuba and went with it.
I love that. Well, speaking of this idea of kind of like purity of lineage or whatever, one of the things I was interested in, I can't remember where I read this, if it was in one of your interviews or if maybe it was like literally in our DMs together or something like ages ago. But I remember somewhere you were kind of talking about how you like consciously made the decision not to make it just like a Cuban trans archive, but to like think expansively with queer. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
I did say that in an interview that I was very inspired by the Archivo de la Memoria Trans in Argentina. And I was like, oh my God, can you imagine a trans Cuban archive? And then I just thought about how limiting that was in a certain way. First of all, I'm gonna have to figure out what's trans and then have to cut it off historically at like, what is it, the 1950s or something like that? Because anything else besides that is just like, gooby dooby, whatever. Everybody's just gender freaking out. And I was like, you know what? I don't need to make this distinction. I don't need to talk for people. And I certainly do not need to, in a way that, you know, if somebody told me in 50 years that they know what my identity is more than me, I'll say, fuck you. Because, you know, who are they to say that? As historians like to do, they like to rename things or whatever. So I created a word, or I chose a word rather, that was kind of in that kind of I guess the weird shadow valley of like, you know, of uncertainty, because I didn't want to put names on people that they didn't have, and I didn't want to exclude people who were on the trans spectrum and just didn't identify that way because they didn't have access to language, or because they didn't, you know, or because trans meant something different back then, or didn't mean anything at all. I didn't want to impose modernity on the past, you know, onto the past. And I feel like queer is a term that is just as easy to apply as it is to throw away, because it really means a lot of things. And it's not as defined as perhaps saying transgender or whatever the hell. So I said that I made that term and I put it in Spanish, you know, as many other activists had done and writers in Latin America, which, by the way, I'll tell you the reception I had from that term in Cuba when I first took the archive there.
Oh, I was very interested.
Yeah. When I first got there, you know, people were like, oh, isn't queer like exporting American theory to Cuba? Isn't that imperialist? And I was like, let me tell you that, you know, the word maricón that you so much fight for, or, you know, pájaro or whatever, all that comes from Spain. And what is this replacement of like colonizer culture? Why do you think that your Spanish language is more pure than, you know, an English term that when it's new and when you create some like Cuban term that can define this, queer can go you know, down the trash chute whenever you want. I'm not married to it. It's just, it's weird or queer enough to like work.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of interesting, this like privileging of words that come from Spain, especially when, you know, Cuba has obviously a variety of Afro-Cuban cultures and indigenous cultures, as well as Chinese culture, many of whom have their own words for kind of queer identities. Like in the Orisha religion in Cuba, there's particular words like Adodi, for example, that Lydia Cabrera in particular is known for popularizing in her books. Do people just like not feel connected to those terms broadly in Cuba?
The thing with Lydia Cabrera, I have to say, is that Lydia, as much as her research, she did the thing that I'm afraid to do, which was she was like, I have research and I'm going to publish it. And, you know, it helped the world, but not the people she was researching about, perhaps. And I think people, one, a lot of research is published outside of Cuba. And I don't know much about her, and I feel like perhaps because she was academic, or perhaps because she had kind of screwed over the Abaqua or stuff like that, people were kind of like, but I did hear a lot of that talk from Tato Quiñones, who was like a cis gay Cuban historian, who was incorporating those words into like, this is Black queer Cuban heritage. I think the reason why it's not incorporated, you know, there are many terms to self-identify in Cuba that are fully not incorporated and people that don't accept. But one of them is one that seems so, you know, basic here. It's, you know, Afro-descendant or, you know, Afro-Cuban. That term, most people reject. A lot of Afro-Cubans reject. Mm-hmm. And a lot of, you know, people reject the word queer. A lot of people reject the word faggot. You know, because they're based on that idea that this is pejorative or whatnot. And, you know, I might be the most radical or whatever, but I love them all. You know, I love the bad ones and the good ones because they're mine now. I think I'll dare say the reason why people don't like take those terms in from the Afro-Cuban culture is... I guess it's like lack of access to them, or a kind of like lack of an organized or like a, if there were a movement that said we are the Adolis or whatnot, you know, that would help with that identification. But I'm not sure if I said the term right. But in Cuba, a lot of even the feminist movement, there's no feminist movement in Cuba. There's no Black movement. You know, there is Black activism, you know, in different places. And there's feminist activism in different places, but they can't get together. They can't come together. Because, you know, everything is government. It's organized at government level. So that's also one of the challenges. And government level run by people who are fucking cis or who are white or who are, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am. This reminds me that last year at some point, one of the Cuban trans women I follow in Havana on Facebook was posting about how like they were trying to organize some animal rights activism, and then the government like pulled the plug on everything and like nobody was allowed to be involved in it at all. So it does sound like sometimes a difficult organizing environment if you go outside the official channels.
I mean, they've even said that, the whole narrative of racism in Cuba and feminism, as I said, the revolution is feminist, the revolution is anti-racist, it eradicated all racism in the 1960s, we're done. We can put that to sleep, you know, and that's so dumb, you know, like, that's so immature. You know, they say that the Federation of Cuban Women is the feminist de facto Cuban organization. Nothing else is necessary. You know, if I would never dare say that, like, my queer archive is the only necessary archive that is needed in Cuba. Hell, fucking make 1,000 of them. And I'm not talking about private market or whatever the fuck. I'm talking about, you know, different opinions and people, you know. I'm a white person living in exile. Hell, if somebody in Cuba could create an archive, that'd be great. And I have to say something that perhaps is like, maybe you hadn't thought about, but a lot of people come to me from Cuba who are, you know, perhaps in a better economic position, or who are cis people who are journalists and stuff like that. They come to me to ask me about the queer Cuban community in Cuba. And I'm like, there's trans women living in Cuba around your house. You can ask her. You don't have to ask me. And I know that a lot of that has to do with respectability, with education, with the privilege I have, and with kind of like the self-title, the kind of me saying I am an archivist or whatever. But if they want information, there is not a shortage of trans women in Cuba. They can really go ask. That's especially for people who are living in Cuba who are asking me to talk about the situation in Cuba. I'm like, I don't know more than a person living in Cuba. I never will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So like, what is kind of your next move? Like, you're continuing to, I've seen you've done a bunch of like interviews with people that you were talking about earlier, those like 5 hour long interviews. You're doing all this stuff. Like, where is this building to next for you?
Well, there's two things coming. Those interviews I started as I was just gonna interview them with a camera. I didn't even have like a separate audio equipment. It was very like, you know, basic, and then post it. And then I was like, wait a minute, there's a lot more information here. And they started donating photos and letters and diaries. And I was like, this is a whole story. And I don't want to keep this. I would hate for some cis person to come into the archive, take everything that I've collected and say, I discovered this, and then make a book about it and ignore all the work that I had done. Because it took me a long time. And, you know, I'm not afraid to say that I don't want like money, like not, I don't want to be like Jeff Bezos from an archive, but I just, you know, I'm struggling to live. I want recognition for my work, and I want to get jobs that are like adequate, not having to work the rest of my life in gigs that have nothing to do with what I love. And I want to be taken seriously for the work I do, because it is important. So my work right now is headed towards getting all the stories together, all the interviews that I compiled, I'm going to transcribe those interviews, tell those stories. And I'm trying to make a book, which is a very hefty kind of task for me, because I've never written a full book or even a lot. But I think it's really important. And I feel for the first time that like cliche writer's thing that I feel like I need to write this. So I'm putting myself in that position in which I will write it. And on the other end, on the archive end, I don't want this to die at a social media capacity. I want this to be an online archive. And more importantly, I want people to touch things. And I know this is kind of like that, if I was, you know, any other archivist would, you know, cringe at that idea. But the difference it made for me to have my history in my hands, and the way it was kept, I guess, for the longest time. You know, when I went to archives and they were like, you're handling it like, you know, a maniac. And I'm like, wait a minute, you have no idea of what's in those files. I want people to touch it. I want people to have access to it. And now I'm like even grappling with the idea of like, do I put a watermark on it? Do I not? Do I, how much do I want to make it fully accessible? Because as much as it is queer people coming to see their history, it's cis people coming and, you know, being voyeurs, and cis historians coming and being like, you know, going to the flea market to get cheap stuff. So that's those are the things that I'm grappling with right now. The website is going to take a while because people have given me a lot of pressure, by the way. They're like, oh, you need to post more, the engagement of the page, and you need to make more content. And I'm like, wait a minute, this is not an OnlyFans. I'm not trying to get engagement for tomorrow. This is a project that I want to love doing for a long time. And this is going to be like, if anything, I want it to be my life project. So I'm not going to get tired of it tomorrow. And I will get tired of it tomorrow if I put too much pressure on myself. So for now, it's been like showing the archives to friends and, you know, preparing content and stuff like that and educating through social media. But hopefully in the next years, I'll have the website ready and going.
Amazing. Well, I can't wait to read a book by you about this. Honestly, it'll be like, I will pre-order it the very moment it becomes available. I'll be so excited. But yeah, again, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to be on One from the Vaults with me. How are people able to follow the archive? How can we contribute to the archive? Like, how do we boost you up? What do we do?
Thank you so much. Cubana Queer is on Twitter. It's on Instagram. It's on Facebook, and it's on Telegram, especially in Spanish only in that platform because it's mostly geared for Latin America. Cubana Queer is spelled C-U-B-A-N-E-C-U-I-R. And it's a mixture, I have to say, of Cubana, which is like a gender neutral way of saying Cuban, and queer, which is the Spanish spelling of queer in English, but it's C-U-I-R. And in terms of boosting me up right now, I have only taken like very random financial contributions for people who just want to thank me. And I've been selling stickers or whatnot, but mostly it's to share them. I have been delaying the donate button for a while because I'm fine right now. I'm a trans person living off of welfare, as they should be. And and I'm good with my Trump money for now. But eventually, I would like to, I'll be ready to receive donations. I'll make an announcement on those social media pages when that's ready. But for now, I'm just happy doing the work I'm doing.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much.
Hoy es tu día, madre de amor. What made you drop out?
Well, a lot of people think it was the 400 acid trips I took, you know.
Uh-huh, but what was it really, Bob?
One day I played CKUT in 90.3.
Then what happened?
I saw God.
You I've saw done God. That. Well, that sounds like true enlightenment to me,
yeah,
Bob.
Yeah, we have been.
And on the seventh day, the Lord said,
let there be a CKUT.
CKUT, 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Écoutez Les Bossons avec Nathalie Di Palma. Sur les ondes de CKUT, le 90.3 FM.
Bonsoir, nous vous offrons une émission littérature et cinéma avec Denis Martin Chabot qui vient nous parler du premier salon Fierté littéraire et Charlie Boudreau avec qui on va s'entretenir sur la 34e édition du Festival de films Imagination LGBTQ+. Mais tout d'abord, on va écouter